In the history of the cinematic Western genre, director John Ford stands alone. And no Western is as acclaimed or as influential as his 1956 classic, The Searchers, starring one of his favorite actors, John Wayne. The film recently placed 7th on the list of the greatest films of all time from Sight and Sound. But what is the story behind the making of this classic film, and how do we explain its enduring legacy that can still be felt in the films we see today? Author Glenn Frankel answers those very questions in his new book, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. The book is now available for purchase. We spoke with Mr. Frankel about John Ford's working methods, the acting prowess of John Wayne, and how this film, which was reasonably acclaimed but largely dismissed upon its first release, forever shaped the future of movies.
From the thrilling pages of life rides a man you must fear and respect. A man whose unconquerable will and boundless determination carved a lusty, rough, and boisterous slice of history called The Searchers. It's John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, who had a rare kind of courage. The courage that simply keeps on and on, far beyond all reasonable endurance, never thinking of himself as martyred, never thinking of himself as brave.
So we'll find him in the end, I promise you. We'll find him.
Here is the story of a man, hard and relentless, tender and passionate, of people who dared to challenge a hostile land. Here is drama of great love and aching loneliness.
I found him. I found Lucy.
What you saw was a buck wearing Lucy's dress. I found Lucy back in the canyon.
What was she?
What do you want me to do? Draw you a picture? Spell it out? Don't ever ask me. As long as you live, don't ever ask me more.
I read your book, and I love this book, and I'm so appreciative of you for writing it.
Well, thanks. That's really good to hear. It's getting a really good response, and I'm just loving that because, you know, I worked on it for about 6 years, so it's really gratifying to see that people are enjoying it.
Well, let me ask you this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because you come from a journalism background, and you've written a lot about world affairs, but not necessarily films. So
right.
What was it about The Searchers that drew you to write a book about it?
Well, I mean, you put your finger on the fact that it was The Searchers that really drew me into this. I don't know a lot about films. Like a lot of people, I love movies and, you know, see a lot of them and have thoughts about them. But The Searchers has always really moved me in some special kind of way. I must have been about 10 or 11 years old when I first saw it, and it was just so exciting. John Wayne was so scary and exciting and powerful, and, you know, it's beautifully filmed. And then I saw it again in college and, you know, started looking at what was going on in it, and it moved me in a different way. And over the years, I've just come back to it over and over again for a lot of reasons, but mostly I think in the end, you know, it's unsettling, but it's ultimately about love triumphing over hate, and that's a very satisfying thing, you know, conclusion to come to at the end of it. I'm not the only one who's felt that way over the years, who's had this sort of special relationship with The Searchers. Some of our great, you know, contemporary filmmakers like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg saw it at a young age. It moved them in all kinds of ways and really, you know, was formative for their careers. So I think it just spoke to people. And it still speaks to people in a way that's just very powerful and really made me want to, you know, I didn't know I was getting into a 6-year deal, but I, you know, really, really wanted to delve a little deeper into how this kind of thing was put together.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to me. there are certain filmmakers and certain films that I could have viewed for the first time 20, 30 years ago, and they meant one thing to me. And now when I revisit them as an older man, they mean something different. Is it that case with you with this particular film?
I think so. I think I've evolved, or it's evolved with me over the years. And I've seen layers in it, and I've seen, but, you know, coming back to, it's a Western, it's a cowboy and Indian movie, it's a John Wayne movie, but ultimately it's about families and about the terrible things that happen and how families attempt to restore themselves. And as I've gotten older, and I've got three now grown-up children of my own and starting to have grandchildren, I mean, that's a very powerful theme. I find it's, but it's an unsettling, very tense narrative. It's almost like every time I see it, I'm not quite sure how it's going to end. And so it still engages me at all kinds of levels, and I still feel like I learn something from it every time I get a chance to see it. It's almost, I wouldn't call it a mystical thing exactly, but it is a very special movie, and you really have to watch it. It's an ambiguous movie. It doesn't explain itself. It makes you come to conclusions, and so in a sense, depending on where you are in life, and, you know, you may come to slightly different conclusions of why things are happening the way they are. It's the work of a very mature artist. John Ford was 60 years old when he made The Searchers, and I think you can tell.
And isn't that the sign of, I mean, by and large, that's usually the sign of a great movie that will last, one that you have to bring yourself to, not one that does the work for you necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
And that could be a big reason why, upon its initial release, people weren't very receptive to it as they are today.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it got good reviews, but it was basically characterized as a pretty good John Wayne cowboy and Indian movie, you know? And people didn't notice, for example, that the protagonist, besides being the charismatic, powerful John Wayne, was also a bit of a psychopath, with a lot of racial and sexual, you know, conflicts to work out, and planning to supposedly rescue his niece, not to restore her to the family, but ultimately to kill her because she'd become a Comanche and had had sexual relations with Comanches, and so all this is going on. And you're right, it just passed by people. I think obviously each generation has its own sensibility, its own sense of values, and sort of processes things that way. And that became one of the things my book was about, because, you know, as I pulled back the string on the original story, true story that is Searchers is loosely based on, I found that every generation comes along and takes, you know, history, takes stories, retells them, embroiders certain parts, you know, drops other parts, and tries to recreate, if you will, a story for their own time to explain their own world. And you can look at The Searchers in that context and see it as one of those manifestations.
So what was it about this material, do you think, that fit Ford's sensibilities?
Well, Ford was, as you know, the great Western filmmaker. He didn't invent the Western movie, but he really refined it and became the great artist of it. He made a number of great ones and started filming them in Monument Valley in the late 30s. And John Wayne, of course, was his principal character. He was Wayne's mentor. There was a loyalty there and affection. So Ford is coming, you know, in the mid-50s from a very tough time. He physically, he's not in great health. He's just come off the set of Mr. Roberts, where he actually punched out his old friend Henry Fonda, the lead actor. And Ford was drinking heavily and then had to have emergency surgery. He needed to be rescued. And his friends saw, you know, no better way to rescue John Ford than to get him another great Western, and in Monument Valley, starring John Wayne. So his friends helped him put this together. Warner Brothers, while they weren't happy with him over Mr. Roberts, was more than happy to do another Western in Monument Valley, and they packed him off. But I think for Ford it was partly an effort at self-rescue, you know, of showing he could still do it. But also, as I say, at 60 years old, his vision had changed. He had a deeper sense of the possibilities of this story. He gives you the mythic John Wayne figure, the man on horseback, the lone gunman, you know, the Indian fighter, the rescuer. But at the same time, he kind of undermines that iconic image at times because, you know, the knight in shining armor also happens to be, as I say, someone who's attempting not to rescue this young damsel, but he's planning to kill her. And I think Ford really got more complex as he got older. His last great Western, in my view, was The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance about 6 years later. And there, too, he's both giving you a story, but he's also examining it closely and showing you the flaws and the, you know, the contradictions. Searchers is all about that. It's all about giving you – it's a very satisfying cowboy and Indian movie, but at the same time, it's giving you something much deeper and much more emotionally complex.
I agree with you, and this is something that fascinates me about his work, in that obviously he's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, director of Westerns we've ever had, and yet he takes the kind of accepted themes of your typical Western and he kind of subverts them or plays with them, and that includes, as you said, the portrayal of kind of a mythic hero like a John Wayne type. So I'm interested to know, was John Wayne always on board with how he was playing with his image in that way?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, the John Wayne we kind of know from growing up was in the 60s and early 70s was, you know, the kind of older, toupee-wearing, not exactly a self-parody because sometimes he was very good, but he wasn't, you know, in his younger years, he was a much more lithe, I would say supple and nimble performer. And he does get challenged. And he works with great directors. He works with Howard Hawks. He works with John Ford, those guys who left the scene by the mid-60s. And so they tended to challenge him more. You know, if you recall Red River, where he plays something, you know, I wouldn't say a psychopath exactly, but a really tough-minded, nasty trail boss who's going to kill his own adopted son, who crosses him. And, you know, he's a force of nature in that movie, but he's also, you know, a dark, complicated character, almost a tragic figure. So Wayne had done these kinds of roles before, and I think Wayne had a lot of trust in John Ford. I think, as all of Ford's people did, all the people who worked with Ford, you know, they put up with a lot of abuse because Ford was a tyrant, and sometimes a petty tyrant, and he liked to pick out weakness, and he was always tough on Wayne. Always insulting him in front of other people. It was part of the tough love, I guess, or, you know, it was the way Ford related to the people he loved. He treated them badly sometimes. But Wayne trusted him artistically. He knew, as the other folks knew, that then when they were working with John Ford, they were really working with a cinematic poet, with someone who delivered some great, great films over the years, some of them Westerns and some of them not. And so Wayne trusted him, and Wayne was willing to go to this place. I talked to Wayne's son Patrick, who had a role, you know, a small role toward the end of the film. And Patrick said his father was prepared to do this, you know, knew it was a big challenge, but really prepared to take it on because he trusted Ford, and he really felt that this was one of his greatest roles. And in the end, you know, he named his last son, Ethan, after the character Ethan Edwards, the character that Wayne played in The Searchers.
And it was a fascinating relationship that the two had, because you hear, just like you said, you hear about Ford being kind of tough as nails and merciless in many ways, but Wayne's respect for Ford was undying. One of my close friends actually did one of the last interviews with Wayne, and it was a fascinating interview, and he spoke glowingly of Ford and particularly The Searchers. He thought it was his best film.
Wayne was a very loyal person. When when he owed you, he paid you back. He paid Ford back again and again. It wasn't just even for films. It was also, you know, if Ford needed someone for a Christmas pageant, if he needed someone to go to a children's hospital, you know, whatever Ford was up to, Ford had Wayne's phone number in his back pocket, and Wayne always picked up and answered. That's just the nature of who Wayne was, I think. And again, but he recognized that with a Ford or with a Howard Hawks, he was being stretched in ways that challenged him, that excited him. He was ready to go there. Wayne is a fascinating character because we still tend to underestimate his artistry, his performances. We forget that Wayne invented a character named John Wayne. This wasn't, you know, who he necessarily was. It wasn't even his name at the beginning, but he was one of the early people, I would say, to figure out what movies were, what movie stardom was about, that intimate connection, that ability to create a persona. So you have to give Wayne, I think, a lot of credit for it. Helped, but it really is Wayne's persona that he built in all those B westerns in the 1930s. So that when he finally gets to Ford and later to Howard Hawks, he's got a, you know, he's got something going that's very, very powerful and really translates well on the screen.
Absolutely. And another thing that really interested me in your book was the description of how Ford worked. And it reminded me a lot of Hitchcock, because Hitchcock used to say, I don't want the studios meddling with my footage, so I tend to only shoot what I absolutely need. And Ford worked much the same way, didn't he?
That's right. There are very few outtakes from John Ford. He didn't want anybody, he didn't even really need a film editor. He just wanted to do what he wanted to do. But, you know, Hitchcock at least sketched out storyboards. Ford was also a great sketcher, but he didn't do storyboards. You know, he did costumes, he did a little of this and that, but you don't see all the storyboards the way you do with Hitchcock. Ford was shooting it in his head before he walked out there, and when he got on, you know, he maneuvered the camera. He worked with these folks over and over, like Winton Hawk, his chief cameraman, and they would set it up. They knew what he was looking for, and he just sort of had a beautiful an ability to frame things on the set in the morning and to have them look absolutely perfect.
Mm. And yet he was very kind of selective, at least in terms of the searchers, he was very selective about how many kind of beautiful vistas he would put in his film. I mean, it wasn't all about the gorgeous landscape. I mean, he kept those to a minimum, didn't he?
Yes, he used them very carefully, and Winton Hawk talked about this. You know, Hawk had won an Academy Award for photography with Ford in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon in the late 40s. They had a cantankerous relationship, too, but both men knew, you know, the qualities of the other. And Hawk talked about the way that Ford was very careful with these gems. He used them sparingly. They didn't overwhelm the narrative. I think maybe you see a little later on in Cheyenne Autumn, which is his last Monument Valley movie. It's a beautiful movie, and it's a movie that I think has gotten its due more in recent years. But it's a little more slack. There's a little more beautiful shots in it because Ford's kind of law. You know, Ford hasn't preserved quite that level of narrative tension. In Searchers, everything serves the narrative. I would argue there's not a wasted shot. And you get the beauty of Monument Valley and the monumentality of Monument Valley, but there's no, you know, there's nothing wasted going on. He's not showing you a beautiful shot just for the sheer beauty of it.
And but such iconic shots in the film too. I mean, it's shots that are echoed in movies even today. He shot absolutely what mattered. I agree with you. But in terms of movies of today, where I can clearly see the influence of something like The Searchers, obviously this generation has embraced Ford to a large extent. When did that tide start to turn? Was it kind of a film school mentality that brought about the resurrection of this film?
I think there were a lot of things going on. People like Hawks and Ford and Hitchcock, for that matter, were considered like good studio hacks in the 50s, you know. It was a time when Hollywood's artistry was not really recognized in general. Then you get in the 60s, you get the French critics, the new wave people like Truffaut and Godard who are citing these guys, not to mention Jerry Lewis, for that matter. And then you get that, coming over to the States, Andrew Saras of the Village Voice, some other folks pushing the auteurist theory. And I remember seeing Searchers at Columbia University in 1970 when Saras first showed it there. So you have that going on, that kind of academic thing going on. You have a resurrection of John Wayne, if you will. And you have the young filmmakers themselves now emerging in the 70s, Spielberg, Lucas, Martin Scorsese, and they're singing the praises. So that by 79, Searchers is being recognized. One critic wrote that just like Hemingway once said that all modern American literature flows from Huckleberry Finn, all modern American cinema seems to flow from The Searchers. And there's a lot of truth to that. You get these guys coming along. Paul Schrader, the screenwriter, has kind of written a script, you know, a postmodern version of Searchers several times, including Taxi Driver, the great Scorsese movie, and Hardcore, which Paul Schrader himself directed. So you have the screenwriter, you have it going on in film schools because there's so many rich themes. You've got the young, successful new wave of great filmmakers who are extolling Ford. And you have a chance to see the movies themselves over and over again. And so all that comes together, I think, to make Searchers, plus a different mentality about race and gender that begins to recognize some of the complexity of what Ford was pulling up there. So on a lot of different levels, it becomes a very satisfying movie. And again, it's a different sensibility in the 80s, in the late 70s and the 80s, and Searchers really begins to emerge. It's climbed to almost the top of the polls. It's certainly often considered the best Western in those polls, but the Sight and Sound poll last year showed it as number 7 of all movies of all time. I don't take too much stock in that, you know. but nonetheless, that's indicative of its staying power and the fact that it still speaks to this generation.
Well, the Searchers and Ford are definitely still a part of the popular vernacular in just recently, in recent months, and this ties into the issue of how he handled race. I don't know if you saw this, you probably did, but when Tarantino was doing press for his last movie, he started talking about John Ford and how he doesn't like him because he considers him a racist, and several of his works racist. Which I found ironic, since it seemed like he copied a lot of Ford's shots in his movies, like Inglourious Basterds. But
of course.
But race was really a kind of prickly issue with the reception of the Searchers.
Absolutely, and you know, John Ford was a man of his time and his era, and he carries around the sensibility of people who came of age in that generation. So I would never, you know, say there's no racism or at least paternalism in those films. I think Ford himself was aware of some of that. He was a, you know, he was a liberal Republican. He claimed, maybe a liberal Democrat. He made one of the most socialist movies I think that's ever come out of Hollywood, which is The Grapes of Wrath in the late 1930s. So he's a progressive in sensibility. But, you know, he treated his Indians paternalistically. In Searchers, you have things that, you know, the Comanches are largely portrayed as killers and rapists and, you know, and brutal people. At the same time as the film unfolds, you get a sense of why the war chief Scar is so brutal, the fact that his two sons were killed by whites, killed by soldiers, that's part of his motivation. I think the whites, you know, the Texans still get the better half of the deal because we see directly the terrible thing that happened to people we know at the beginning of the Searchers with the Indian raid on the family farm. But later in the film, we see a Comanche village that has been raided, and we see dead bodies, and we see women and children as well as men who have been killed by soldiers. We don't know those people in the same way we knew the family in the first part of the movie. So it's complex. Again, I don't want to make the case that he's a great egalitarian and that Searchers is, you know, some people have said, well, it's a racist film about racism. I don't want to go there particularly. I don't want to label people one way or the other or works like this one way or the other. All I say is that there's a lot there and that it's much too facile, you know, for Tarantino to come along and say, well, he was a racist. Tarantino was citing the fact that Ford, you know, appeared on horseback as an extra in Birth of a Nation, you know, was a Klansman on horseback in 1915. Well, was D.W. Griffith, was that a racist film? Of course it was. You know, Ford trying to get ahead in Hollywood and get a job? Of course he was. It's too glib. And Tarantino himself has too much respect for film and film history to really kind of, I think, believe what he was saying there.
I feel the exact same way. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting too because you pay great attention to the making and the reception of the film, and also, as you mentioned, a lot of time in your book is dedicated to the actual origin story. Was it difficult to find sources?
For the original story, or for the whole thing?
For the whole thing, because it was a 6-year journey for you. Was that a challenge?
It was definitely a challenge, but it was a great challenge. First of all, there are archives. There are archives in Texas and all over the Southwest of the history of the area, and some great ones here at the University of Texas at Austin, but other ones all through North Texas and Oklahoma. So I was really wallowing in archives for that. And then there's Hollywood, and, you know, I went to UCLA has the papers of Alan LeMay, the novelist who wrote The Searchers, and I had a lot of fun there. John Ford's papers are in Indiana University, thanks to his grandson, Dan. You know, so there was plenty of written material, but as you pointed out earlier, I'm a journalist. It's not just a question of the written material. I want to meet people and I want to go places. And you could see things. You could go to Monument Valley and see some of the sites where Ford shot the film. You could go to Texas and Oklahoma and see some of the sites where the little battles took place, where Cynthia Ann Parker, the 9-year-old who was kidnapped by Comanches in the 1830s, who's the forerunner, the prototype, if you will, of Debbie Edwards in The Searchers, you know, you could see the place where she was kidnapped. Then you could go and see the place where she was eventually recaptured by Texas Rangers and cavalry in 1860. You could go to the Texas Panhandle and see the Comanche strongholds, Palo Duro Canyon. So I found that really useful and really important. And, of course, when it came time to interview people about Searchers, I was lucky enough to still meet some people who were still alive or relatives of people like Dan Ford, John Ford's grandson, or Kevin Nugent, who was the son of Frank Nugent, the screenwriter, or Harry Carey Jr., who I had the great privilege of interviewing in 2009, who died this past January. I mean, he was wonderful to talk to, or Pippa Scott, who was played a supporting role in the film, and who was, again, this was fabulous to be able to talk to these folks or to email back and forth, you know, with Patrick Wayne. So it was a great challenge. It took 6 years in part because I had full-time jobs teaching journalism at Stanford University and then at the University of Texas. But because it just got to be a more and more ambitious project as I went along. What I thought was going to be like maybe a coffee table book about the movie became something much more about America and about the founding of the West. And but that's why, you know, in the end, that's why I loved working on it.
Well, and to the benefit of everyone that loves movies, I mean, reading the book was a complete pleasure. I wanted to ask you another question about the materials. Isn't there, that I read in your book, there the outtakes or additional footage from the movie is missing?
Well, yes. Some of it's clearly missing. A couple of people have gone at it. You know, in 1998, a fellow named Nick Redman did a wonderful documentary called A Turning of the Earth about Searchers, and he had access to the Warner Brothers archives, and he couldn't find... He's got a couple of outtakes he actually shows at the beginning of the documentary, but they were sparse. Leith Adams, who's the great archivist at Warner's, has gone on a long search, a search for the Searchers, and has found almost nothing. And there had to be more outtakes. I mean, you know, even Ford didn't cut everything in the camera. You know, there's continuity things. There are things going on where clearly that are more outtakes somewhere. But whether they've simply vanished, hard to say. Another great mystery. I mean, Ford was shooting the making of the Searchers at the time. He had Brick Marklund out there. He had some people working on that. Jeffrey Hunter brings some of that footage, in fact, on Warner Brothers Presents, a show that they did, you know, a publicity show that they would do on TV in 1956. And Hunter shows us 9 reels, and he says, these are all the reels of, you know, of people taking a movie of the movie, and, you know, and he shows us some of that. Well, nobody knows where those reels are either at this point. So, you know, stuff tends to vanish, and Leith Adams has gone through every nook and cranny of the warehouse. That doesn't mean it won't show up someday. You never know where things go, but it is a mystery.
That's always fascinating to me, because you know it's in someone's attic somewhere.
Exactly.
To me, yeah.
But so many of these people, their papers and their attics have been looked at. Marion Cooper's papers are at Brigham Young University. His family gave them there. Ford's stuff, is in Indiana. Alan LeMay's stuff, one of the frustrating things, there are 23 boxes of Alan LeMay's files and notes, but there's no real searcher's box. So that box, or three boxes, or five boxes, didn't quite make it. And his widow has died. His children are wonderful. They were wonderfully helpful to me, but they don't know where the boxes are. These are mysteries, and sometimes they get cleared up, Jamie, over time, and sometimes we just have to live with them.
Yeah. One last question for you. This might be a strange question, but reading your book and hearing stories about old Hollywood, I'm always struck by how big those personalities were. I mean, a figure like John Ford or somebody like Robert Mitchum or very authentic people and big personalities. And I find that in movies today, we don't have those so much. Is it just kind of romanticizing the past, or is there something different with filmmaker culture nowadays?
I think that's a really good question. I've thought of it in terms of, well, if they ever dared to make Searchers again or to try, and I don't know that anyone ever will, could someone play Ethan Edwards? I mean, Jeff Bridges did a wonderful job, in True Grit, I think. He played it much differently, but he did a fine job with it. And, we've gamed this a little, my wife and I, occasionally, could Harrison Ford have done Ethan Edwards? Could Kevin Costner possibly do it? I think there are still some great movie personas. I think of Tom Hanks, for example, not for a John Wayne role, but in his own way as a real persona. I think there are people who have inherited Jimmy Stewart's mantle. Wayne is really hard to inherit because he's such a special, unique character. But I love, I still love movies, and I still love great movie stars. I think there are people out there who still have a lot of magic, as far as I'm concerned, who I want to watch, and I love to watch Jeff Bridges. I love Kevin Costner. I think, I'll watch, movies that I don't necessarily love to see Kevin Costner try to feel his way through. Not everyone would agree with me on any of this, but... So I'm not sure. Certainly the system allowed someone like a John Ford to come along. But I find, Spielberg and Scorsese to be very, very compelling figures. And some of the younger folks coming along now, can be that figure too. I think each generation has to reinvent their love of movies. There's no popular art form that has risen in this way and that really still, captures our imagination so intensely. And that hasn't really changed. It's been transformed in the platforms we use and where we can see it at home and all this and that. But there's still a magic there that I think is quite powerful.
I couldn't agree more, obviously. I dedicate a lot of my life to that power
right.
of movies. So bless you for writing this book. It's amazing. And I'll recommend it to all of our listeners. So thank you so much.
Well, Jamie, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.